So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, we'll discuss the latest trends to come out of the LA screenings. Spoiler, they're mostly from 1987. And I'll talk to presenter Rory Reid ahead of the relaunch of Top Gear this Sunday. Also on the show, there's no change to the TV terms of trade. There's more signs of unease in Fleet Street as the Daily Mail's owners issue a profit warning. Chris Moyles has a tough time in the latest radio listening figures. And I promise, there will be almost no mentions at all of the BBC White Paper. How liberating is that? It's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me this Friday at a suspiciously quiet hospital club, it is a sunny afternoon, is the creative director of Folder Media and all-round radio dude, Mr. Matt Deegan. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Hello, nice to be here.
Preparing for next radio conference at the moment, I guess?
Absolutely, 19th of September, kind of you to ask.
Big names you can reveal at this stage?
We'll be announcing the first wave on Wednesday.
Oh, so come on.
Keep tuned
Give
to
us a
Twitter.
Rumor, nothing.
Good radio folk and more.
Good radio folk. Good times for radio at the moment? Good atmosphere there, do you think?
Yeah, I think we're in a great period. Revenue's up, more stations launching. I think if you want to work in it, there's never been so many opportunities.
Nice. Okay, it's good to start with some optimism, isn't it, before we move on to the inevitable cynicism. Alongside Matt this week on the panel, multi-award-winning producer, the man behind the Royal Family, Him and Her, Friday Night Dinner. It is the CEO of Big Talk Productions, Mr. Kenton Allen. Hello, Kenton.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, well, it's a podcast. Could be any time.
Any time
you
like.
On demand. You're a very busy chap. Tell us what you've been working on at the moment, and it better be Cold Feet.
It is Cold Feet.
Hey.
I've just come back from Manchester, where we wrap Cold Feet a week today.
And you're not going to tell me anything about that
either,
are you?
Well, I can tell you a few things about it. I've seen the first 4 episodes, and can't wait to share them with the audience.
It's tricky, isn't it, reviving a classic show?
We're not reviving it, though. It's series 6.
Well, that's the crucial distinction,
isn't it? There's just been a 14-year gap between series 5. So it's not... It's importantly, it's not a reboot. It's not Poldark. We're not remaking something. It's the original 5 cast members, apart from Helen Baxendale, whose character died in series 5, and it's just series 6. It happens to be 14 years later, but it is the next series. So it's not a reboot. It's not a reimagining. It's the same show.
And can you re-engender that spirit on set as if, you know, that decade in the middle didn't happen?
Well, it was fascinating because I didn't work on the original series. So getting the 5 actors back together again with Mike Bullen, the original creator, it's the same team writing and acting. So it was pretty special when they all met. They hadn't really seen each other that much over the last 14 years. So, it was a high wire act.
And you've also got Raised by Wolves as well, which is now heading to the States.
Yep.
You've worked with Caitlin Moran for a while, haven't you? Naked City.
I met Caitlin when she was 18 and I was a little bit older when she was a presenter on Naked City with Johnny Vaughan. She hated me when she was presenting Naked City. She happily tells me often. And we're now working together again on Raised by Wolves. And we've just... We haven't announced it. In fact, The Guardian got hold of it somehow. I blame Catelyn. It's just been revealed that Diablo Cody, who is the Oscar-winning writer of Juno, is adapting it for the US. So that's quite exciting news.
So she's in a position to tell you she hates you, even though you're an important man.
Yes, she is. Yes. She doesn't hate me anymore.
No.
She now loves me.
Just remember him on the way down, Caitlin. That's the important thing. Now, just as we've come to air, if you like, although, as I say, it's a podcast, we've just heard about the PAC Terms of Trade. Yep. John Whittingdale says no changes.
No changes. Excellent news. PAC Terms of Trade remains. So the fantastic mechanism which has enabled British TV to be world-beating stays in place. So all John Whittingdale needs to do now is leave Channel 4 alone, and jobs are gooden, as we say.
Was there a real serious worry that they wouldn't stay in place?
Yes.
And did that intensify once the white paper for the BBC came out? Sorry, I know I said I wouldn't mention
it. No, it's been running alongside that, but it's been a separate campaign about terms of trade. Whittingdale's review of sort of everything threw up questions about terms of trade, but PAC's had a fantastic lobbying campaign, and they speak a lot of sense, and Whittingdale has happily listened.
And are there similar concerns for radio indies, Matt, about all of this? Or can we now finally breathe easy? You know, John Whittingdale is the culture secretary and it's all fine.
Well, there's a big change.
That's a sentence I haven't heard very often.
There's a big change for radio, because radio's never had kind of quotas, sort of formal quotas. But now, from the white paper, up to 60% of BBC radio, national BBC radio output, can be contestable. And that's a huge amount of hours that are accessible for indies. And what that also hopefully means that for the in-house teams that keep programmes as well, it makes them work harder, and the net result should be good for listeners. But I think for the independent sector, a lot of opportunities, and also for people who work in the BBC or for the BBC, opportunities to create their own indies or think about things a different way, because there's a lot of work that they can win.
Presumably, BBC radio production will become part of BBC Studios.
There's no plan for it to become part of Studios. I think it's because there isn't really anyone else to buy the programming except for the BBC.
Yeah.
It's commercial radio. That is
quite an odd. That's an odd situation in terms of the great. Certainly, in comedy, there is a great history of things moving from radio to TV. So that's fascinating and makes no sense.
But then equally, there's some kind of radio
broadcasting policy.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But then equally, there are some kind of programs that the BBC makes on radio that really no one else does make. It's not like in telly where they say only we can make this and they're lying. I mean, you know, there is no one else set up to make that kind of show.
Yeah, and to a certain degree, so news is pretty much protected.
Yeah.
So news, and there wouldn't be any economic value in not using the BBC's newsroom and news resource to do those sorts of shows. But even like something like The Archers, it's a drama.
I used to work on The Archers.
Well, it's writing.
My first job, I was the spot effects man on The Archers.
We could
make The Archers very
easily. Were you the guy in the background going,
yep,
there's somebody
I
at the door?
Art Laura's dead body wrapped in quarter-inch tape running around the floor. Eddie Grundy, lots and lots of this sort of thing. Find a Shires, please, Eddie. That sort of nonsense.
And what caused you to leave, Kenton? That sounds like a potentially very long-running career.
I think I was asked to leave, actually.
What did you do wrong? Did she suddenly come
alive? Well, the great thing about radio, or the Archer Studio, is it has a fully practical kitchen. And I used to get in at 7 a.m. and cook myself a full English breakfast, which apparently the actors didn't appreciate when they came in at 8. It's something to do with the smell.
I can imagine that creating a country cottage vibe very well,
absolutely.
Actually.
Yeah.
I can exclusively reveal the kitchen on the set of Lorraine is real as well, but not all of it.
Oh.
You've got to be careful. No extractor fan. Right, that went very badly. We've mentioned the white paper a lot. This will be a Whittingdale-free zone from now on, I promise. It's actually, kind of because of the white paper last week, been the quietest fortnight for media news for quite a long time. So instead of Britain, we're going to turn immediately to LA, somewhere even sunnier than today on a nice Friday in the summer. Lots of interesting trends coming out of the LA screenings. Now, this is where indie TV companies meet to sell their shows in the open market. We've mentioned Raised by Wolves already, but there have been many other shows talked about, of course. Matt, one of the big themes seems to be reboots.
Yes, if in doubt, go back to something that some people liked and have another go at it. And you see it in film and television, that doesn't seem to be stopping. But also, obviously, at the same time, explosion in TV broadcasters, for want for a better word, Netflixes and Amazons of the world, who are hungry for content.
Is this all the fault of Fargo? basically. You know, they've suddenly realised if you've got a brand that even wasn't that popular as a film, but it's a recognisable name, you're more likely to build a successful TV show around
it. By saying fault, you're suggesting it's a problem.
And I think it can feel depressing everything is something we've heard before.
I don't think audiences think that, because the audiences to Fargo are huge and the show is exceptionally good. So I think it's more complicated than that, because with the amount of opportunity to watch things that's out there now, if you're investing millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in a TV franchise, getting an audience to it in the first place is incredibly challenging. So having a title that has some brand recognition and that will cut through in an incredibly cluttered marketplace is clearly something that, when done correctly, can pay huge dividends.
Okay, but let's look at some of these titles, because they really are, you know, going back to the 80s, MacGyver, Lethal Weapon, The Exorcist.
I learned a long time ago not to judge things until I'd seen them. So I would reserve judgment. We have some reboots in the works. We are developing Educating Rita, the film and stage play, as a returning TV series. I'm not supposed to tell you that, but I just have. And there are other things on our slate which are reboots or taking a title from another medium and moving it to TV. So I can understand why you think it looks like it's cheap and unimaginative. There's nothing cheap about this process. And as long as it's done imaginatively and with flair and brilliance and all those things that you need, then why not?
But my point is, I guess, if you see a script and it's a buddy cop TV show and it's not called Lethal Weapon, doesn't it have to work that little bit harder to be original and interesting?
Everything has to work hard to be originally interesting. I think you're using the title and the brand recognition and the useful baggage from the incredibly successful global movie franchise to try and get an audience to your $100 million investment.
So for something like that project you've just talked about, do you do any research with audiences and like their perception of it or what they thought about it that helps influence the direction you take it in, or does the creative team just go?
No, it's driven by us and the writer, and it's on instinct and what we think is best practice. And no, we don't research titles and go, well, that would be good because 100 people in the street would say they'd like to see it. That's a different sort of job. That's not the job I want to do.
Okay. And you were talking earlier about how it had been 14 years or whatever since the last series of Cold Feet, but it's the same show.
Yeah.
On that basis, is it too soon to say 24, that's not a new series, that's a reboot? I mean, it's only been, what, 3 or 4 years since the last series? Prison Break
It's 24 Legacy, isn't it? So it's a different... It's, again, using the architecture of the original series, but it's a completely different cast. It's a sort of diffusion range spin-off of the original brand. But if you've got such a powerful brand and you've pumped millions of dollars into it and you have sales globally and lots of networks have bought it internationally, then I don't see the issue with having a spin-off series from that.
Okay, let's talk about who does buy these programs internationally, because it sort of feels a bit to me as a viewer like I sort of imagine if it's an American show and it's not on Sky Atlantic, it will probably be shit. Is that fair? I mean, have they just hoovered because they've got Showtime, they've got HBO? It's rare, isn't it? The People versus OJ Simpson was brilliant. If you see something on the BBC, you sort of assume it won't be as good.
Those networks just said no to it. So either it's more niche and it's going... It's like the Nordic equivalent of pick up on
something. Yeah, no, I mean...
But AMC UK hasn't been taking all the AMC US stuff, have they?
No, because there is an economic value to AMC selling their best shows up to the highest bidder, to Channel 4 or to Sky. And, you know, the Sky output deals with Showtime and HBO means there's some shit there as well. Vinyl, $48 million dollars for the pilot, Martin Scorsese, Jagger, all of that. It's not very good.
No.
Or it's disappointing. And there's a hugely competitive market for those shows. Obviously, the Sky output deals that they do cost them a lot of money, and they use it to drive subscription. But there's plenty of great American acquisitions on Channel 4. You've got the deepest pockets for acquisitions in terrestrial broadcasters. And actually, I don't really want ITV and BBC to be competing for those shows. I want them to spend their money on original British content.
Yeah, I mean, it tends not to work, actually, when ITV buys a big American series, doesn't it? They had The Americans, they had Dexter, but they tend to sort of put it out once and then squirrel it away at 11 o'clock at night.
It hasn't really ever worked for them in recent years. I can't remember what has worked for them, but the days of Dallas playing at 8 p.m. on BBC One are gone, you know, and thank God, because what we want with our licence fee is for that money to be invested in original British content, British actors, British writers, British producers, not going to very well-funded and rich Hollywood studios. So in many ways, it sort of happened by market forces, but that the quota system, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, the Netflix quota system, is a really good thing for British audiences and British creatives.
And also, I think that I think there is an issue with some American shows, and people who'd be really big fans and would maybe drive the enthusiasm of it, is that they've already seen them before they start to be broadcast in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that needs to be millions of people. Having 100,000 super fans who've BitTorrented a series, yes, they'll be positive about it, but I think it does weaken the takeoff of some of those things. And you see, yeah, Game of Thrones try and get as close to simulcast as possible to nip that in the bud. Yeah. I think that's had a bit of an effect.
Yeah, I saw someone who was in charge of acquisitions at ITV saying they might be looking for something for the Baywatch slot. I thought that was an interesting reference because that was about 20 years ago. But I sort of know what they mean, you know, yeah, pre-tea time on Saturday.
Yeah. There's lots of content out that you can acquire, and spending huge amounts of money in that tea time slot, as was recently proved with Jekyll and Hyde and Beowulf, is a very high-risk strategy, and you can lose a lot of money. So acquiring something at a lower cost...
With a big brand, like you were just saying
with
before.
With a big brand, and that's an interesting thing for them to do. Baywatch was ITV, wasn't it?
It was
a huge show for them. So maybe that's an interesting strategy for them about how to spend their programming budget strategically and commercially in an area of the schedule where there's not much money, but where they could grow a scripted brand.
Have you been to the LA screenings before?
Yes. I've been as a producer, but it's the studios that are selling the shows, not the producers. So it's Sony and Warner Brothers, and along with the networks, so it's a frenzy of people trying to sell you things.
A lot of lunches, I imagine.
There's a lot of watching television. I know it doesn't sound exhausting. It is exhausting because you're in there watching shows back to back to back to back to back all day, every day for a week.
Nothing like that in the radio industry, is there, Matt?
No, there's no radio upfronts. But yeah. What in America, what you're finding now is people like NPR and iHeartRadio have started to create their own upfronts for their internet-driven audio series. So something like Serial has kicked off a sort of interest in non-traditional radio, and they've had to create an event for it. And so tying into the online upfronts has been quite successful for those new entrants.
And of course, in a podcasting upfront, I guess what the creators of the shows are looking for are advertisers rather than people to host them, because it's all free online.
Yeah, there are some of those shows now that get on broadcast networks, but I think it's kind of to create noise. Obviously, I'm waiting for the spin-off of this show, the American version, South American version. You can find the Portuguese Oli Man, and maybe that could be a big success.
We're working, I didn't want to talk about it on the show, but we're working on an American version with Matthew Perry. Actually, you've effortlessly segued us into talking about our next story, which is staying in the US, but is about podcasts. The podcast stat trackers PodTrack, who monitor downloads for a huge host of US networks, have released some really juicy figures. What PodTrack do is you put their address into the RSS feed so they can track, they say more accurately than anyone else in the world, exactly how many people are downloading your show. So there's an issue with podcasts. Sometimes someone might download it twice, or sometimes it might be a bot. They claim to get rid of all of that so they can have stats they can sell advertisers. What do you think, Matt, of the idea that they've actually made these statistics public, presumably without the permission of the people who actually own the shows who have these stats?
Well, if I was tracked by them, and I'm sure paying for the privilege, I'd be somewhat shocked to see my numbers published. So,
nobody asks us to, but they publish the figures of our television shows. I don't really understand that.
But it's not Barb who are selling your commercials, I suppose.
No.
But you do know when you put a show on, that's going to happen.
Yeah, but why the secrecy?
Well, I think one of the interesting bits from the PodTrack data is download data is still really flaky. And no matter who says they think it's accurate, they're wrong, because just because I download a podcast does not mean I've listened to it.
You're breaking my heart.
It doesn't mean or that I've had it on in a room with 20 people listening to it. It's not an accurate measure. It's an okay metric to have, comparing everyone in the same way. But also, I think it probably better reflects bigger podcasts than smaller ones. So if I'm new to podcasting, you know, I hit a Serial button, or I hit Football Weekly or something like that, because it's got name recognition. And you know, most podcast listeners, when you look at their podcast player, there are a lot of unlistened to episodes, and it gets to a point where they just delete off the ones they're never going to get around to. And that's one of the issues. We work with Fun Kids, we work with an Australian company called Omni, who track all of our audio on the web and in downloads. And when you really look at the download data, it does odd things. one of the things they're doing is they're tracking the live streaming data, which is much more accurate, much more accurate. Some data that came out yesterday from Edison Research is showing that the subscribing and the save as downloading is dropping off as a podcast consumption thing, and actually what's happening is people are pressing play and streaming it. And when they're streaming a file, much more easy to track how far do they get through it, and that's much more connected to what their listening's like.
I've just looked at my phone. I've got 27 downloaded and listened to podcasts because they're automatically downloaded.
But I mean, as you were hinting, actually, although there might be grievances within the industry, actually this shows, doesn't it, that people want to take podcasting seriously as a medium.
Absolutely. It's another new form of content. What is the top podcast then, according to their data?
Well, the NPR network is the number one rated network. Actually, if you look at individual shows, I think, judging from that, 99% Invisible is doing bloody well. Roman Mars is in the top 10 with just one show. Right. I think it's about number 8, whereas NPR have 25 shows or something.
Yeah, I was sort of surprised. I haven't got the numbers to hand, but I think when you get to kind of 9 or 10, some of those networks like CBS with 40 different series, and that could be over a month, 100 plus episodes. Actually, when you start dividing it down to how many listens that they're getting, 5,000-10,000, not very big. I think the interesting thing about Serial in the UK anyway, so Commode and Mayo's Five Live show has more consumption than Serial does.
It's an excellent show. I've got 14 episodes of it downloaded.
still to listen to.
Yeah.
But I think it doesn't necessarily have the sexiness of the super podcast experience, but it does show there's a lot of material out there that is consumed a great deal.
I should clarify, actually, PodTrack have only tracked the shows that have put their code into their RSS, which is only about 75% of commercial American shows. It doesn't include anything on the BBC.
And next month it might be a shorter list.
Indeed, yes, quite right. Kenton, as well, just whilst we're talking about podcasts, I should ask you about podcasts making it to telly, because No Such Thing as a Fish is now on BBC Two in a form.
Yes.
Is that a wise investment by these channels, or is it actually just cheap programming?
I don't think it's cheap programming. I think it's a way of discovering new talent. It enables people who don't need to ask permission to make something to make something. So that's what the digital revolution has done. It's enabled all sorts of people to make content.
I suppose the reason it's cheap is you don't actually have to be involved in the development. Someone's created a show, made it for 5 or 10 years, and then you come along and say, come and do it on our channel, and there's less risk, I guess.
But that's always been the case of, people have been doing stand-up shows at Edinburgh for 5 or 10 years and putting stuff on YouTube. It's the risk is still there. The transference of an audio-only format to television, and a visual medium, is hugely risky and hugely challenging and hugely difficult. I haven't seen the Fish podcast. I don't know how telegenic those individuals are or how that show works as a TV show, but it doesn't make it any easier. The risk is still there. It's just a great bit of A&R for finding new talent, new voices.
I watched the first episode of that. I was sort of surprised how cheap it looked. And there's a bit of me that went, actually, this is late. This is quite late on BBC Two, a constricted BBC. Are we going to see actually a bit more of this? Or, as someone on my Twitter feed says, I'll lend them my DSLR and maybe I'll look a bit better.
That's the issue, isn't it? Is that John Lloyd pitched it to the head of BBC News, I think. It's been produced by News. So he's bypassed the normal commissioning processes because he hates them and finds them irritating and just wants to make it. So he brilliantly found a path of least resistance, but with no real money there, so it's being made it's being made at very low cost. The problem is that you then judge that against all other panel shows, and it's not the same as all other panel shows because of its history. And
also, possibly you say this is how all podcasts will be when they transfer to TV, and
well,
of course,
that's not necessarily true at all.
I was sort of torn. I was watching it thinking, is this bad television, or actually is it going, it doesn't necessarily matter what it looks like, the guys were very funny, they are well practiced because they've done the podcast. But it did just make me sit there sort of just think about it for the 20 minutes it was on.
Okay, well, a TV show everyone will be judging this weekend is the relaunch of Top Gear. And one of the less well-known presenters is Rory Reid. Rory took part in the open auditions, but he's actually a motoring journalist of some years standing by trade. Recently, I interviewed him for my other show, The Modern Man, and here is a section of the interview that hasn't been heard before, exclusively for the Media Podcast. Let's listen. One of your Facebook posts a couple of months ago said, does anyone know a black stunt driver? I'm guessing they'd never used a black stunt driver before.
No. They've never had a black presenter. And when I say stunt driver, what happens is...
Oh, I've opened a box of worms now, haven't I? I know you're driving the car.
Not always, but here's what happens. If we have multiple cars to film and one presenter, such as what happened in Scotland on the Mustang shoot. We have multiple units, so I'll be in one car with the yellow Mustang, for example, and I'll be reviewing all three cars, but I can't drive them all at once. If a car is not moving and not being filmed, time's being wasted. So we have a second unit where they're in charge of getting the shots of maybe a close-up of the wheels moving or something, or the car driving down a road in a straight line or whatever. And I can't drive three cars at once, so we need someone who vaguely looks like me that can pass for the guy that's you know, dude that's driving a car in a particular location. And yeah, it's tough because, you know, if there's a white guy suddenly in a shot, it's going to look super weird.
Yes, that would look weird.
Which is why I asked for any black stunt.
And did they find a British black stunt driver?
They haven't yet. No. So I do a lot of driving. Ollie.
Brilliant. You get to do more of your own stunts.
Yeah, exactly. I do all my own stunts. I do a lot of driving.
And part of the format of the show is about the sort of interpersonal relationships between all the people presenting it. So I think this is a fair question. Yeah. Who would you most like to go for a drink with?
Sabine. Because Sabine's mental. I've been to her house already. I've been for a drink with Sabine.
Nice.
She's got a cockerel called Adolf. She's got a wild pig as a pet. She has horses. And you walk in and there's...
Sounds a lot like you selling a story to the press right now. One of your co-presenters.
Yeah. No. Well, this will be out there. We have a spin-off show called Extra Gear.
Actually, one other point. Almost everyone else in the presenting lineup is a millionaire.
Yeah.
What's that like? I mean, just, you
know. They might all be. Yeah, they might all be millionaires.
But, I mean, Eddie Jordan stands out, but obviously Chris Evans not exactly a pauper.
He's loaded, yeah.
Does that change, like, what you can talk about and how you talk about things, do you think?
No. I haven't spent as much time as I'd like with everyone else because all of my films that I've shot for this new series are solo. So it's me in a car by myself. But in the studio, which we start filming next week, that's when we'll get an idea of the banter between the presenters in a studio environment. So I'm interested to see how that goes. After I talk to you, I'm going to go and hang out with Chris Harris because he's going to co-host Extra Gear. Mm-hmm. So we're going to sit down and go through the scripts and the format for the show and figure out how that's going to go. Maybe we won't have any chemistry, but you know that's what you have to do. You have to hang out with people and see what happens.
If I were you, I'd have a big picture of Matt LeBlanc on my wall at home, and I just keep saying Matt. Otherwise,
instead
first
of
time
Joey.
I meet him, Joey.
For Extra Gear, we were filming some behind-the-scenes stuff featuring him, and my Extra Gear camera crew had been told by the powers that be, don't get in Matt's face, don't talk to him. You know, they'll handle it. You know, they'll take him to one side and figure it out. And they were like, okay, we won't get in his face. And Matt pulls up, he sees me, he goes, hey, Rory! And he immediately walks over, and I just call the camera crew over, let's talk. And he's totally down to earth. Like, we started filming, I'm like, look, Extra Gear's here, we're filming you behind the scenes today. He's like, okay, cool, no problem.
Yeah, it's good cop, bad cop, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got it. That's the secret. My experience talking to celebrities, you've got to be really nice, but then you've got to have people around you who are like, do not look him in the eye.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
That's what you need to get your agent on that.
Yeah. No, but he's a cool guy. Chris Evans, I've worked with him a couple of times on this new series, and he's a perfectionist, that guy. It's nice watching him work, because as he's preparing himself for what he's going to say in a particular segment, he's also directing everyone around him. So as he's running through his lines, he'll see a cameraman standing in the wrong place and he'll say, no, you need to move. You need to come over here because I want it shot from this angle. So he's thinking how it's looking on TV from all angles, directing the cameraman. He's not the director, but he knows how TV is made. He knows what makes him and the car look good. So watching him work is fascinating.
Rory Reid there, you can watch him on Top Gear this Sunday and you can hear the rest of that interview. There's 25 minutes more of it that's completely different to that. We talk about how he got the job on Top Gear and how he's been affected by the tabloids looking into his personal life on my other show, also produced by producer Matt, The Modern Man. You can find us at modernman.co.uk or of course we're on iTunes as well, itunes.com/man. Kenton, are you going to be watching on Sunday?
Absolutely.
And what you said, you wouldn't judge anything before you've seen it.
Nope.
But I'm asking you to.
Completely open mind. What will be fascinating is not what happens on Sunday, because we'll all have our own view of the show and how it performs and what Evans is like and what the new team are like and how much of the format they've retained. So, you know, all of those brilliant clocks and ideas, are they still in there? And we know the star in the reasonably priced car is now a star in a reasonably priced Mini. That format tweak, which is not going to knock anybody's socks off. The real question is how many viewers will be there in episode 6, because the initial show will be huge. Let's put a bet on 6-7 million.
Oh, I like it. Let's play your cards,
okay.
Right.
I'm going to go. Higher or lower? I'm going to go 8.
Wow, you've already gone higher on your own estimation.
Well,
seven.
That's
going 7.
Yeah. But how many of those will hang around?
Yeah.
By episode 6 will be the real test of it. I'm sure the show will be entertaining, and you know, you either like Evans or you don't. There's enough variety in the range of presenters there to make it interesting. It's just how original will it be, and how much will you miss the kind of sitcom family of Clarkson, Hammond and May, and that brilliant chemistry they built up over many years. It's very hard to create that instantly, and I'm sure Matt LeBlanc will be brilliant, and he's a very funny individual, but has he got chemistry with Evans? Is that something that's going to keep us coming back?
Well, this is the concern, isn't it? It's basically an entertainment format, isn't it, more than a motoring show? And with entertainment formats, they tend not to hit the ground running. So although this is a show that's been going for decades, actually this should be viewed, shouldn't it, as the first episode of a new thing.
Rebooted Top Gear Season 1 has a different presenter lineup than the three of them. I think what's interesting with this is they've got a little bit of freedom to see how well each of those 7 presenters do. Because also when it was announced to what it is now, being more of a two-hander between Matt LeBlanc and Chris Evans, they didn't talk about that. I think that sounds like something they have seen as the probably they've done the filming of those all those little films. But it gives them a bit of room to see who does well, also in which territories around the world those people do well. I mean, this is a proper international show that needs to work in multiple places.
It is, and interestingly, Matt LeBlanc's just had a sitcom picked up by CBS, so he's on a CBS sitcom contract, which will be a 5-year minimum deal for 22 episodes a year. His availability,
that's called.
Yeah, I mean, his availability to shoot Top Gear will be challenging if he's on the American sitcom cycle. If he's brilliant and they want to go again, they're going to have to wait for him for quite a long time, or they have to rethink or do something else. So it's going to be fascinating.
There's also, you alluded, 7 presenters. We were betting on how many people are going to be watching. Would you be prepared to bet how many of the 7 will still be there in a year's time? I think Rory's going to be all right because he's presenting Extra Gear, so even if he gets booted off the main show, he's got his own spin-off. But what about everyone else? 6 other presenters, do we still think they're going to be part of the lineup in a year's time?
It becomes very easy to say they're busy with other projects and they can't come back for another year.
Apologies for this, but it could be a bit of a car crash.
And with that, let's go to the break.
That should be on that bombshell.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Right, on with our next story in just a moment. That isn't this bit. You know what this bit is. This is the bit where we ask you for your money. Yeah, you don't get off that lightly. If you haven't taken out a voluntary subscription to the Media Podcast yet, why not? You will help support the show. You will help us make the show. It is with your money that we are able to deliver this show to your ear holes. Go now to themediapodcast.com/dedicate and pledge what you can. Now we'll go back to the show. Right, time now for some stories in brief, and let's talk print, well, digital news anyway. Alan Rusbridge, a former editor of The Guardian, has decided not to take up the role of chairman of the Scott Trust, which owns The Guardian Media Group. He was due to start that in September. Matt, this has been seen as a bit of a coup for Kath Viner, the current editor. Of course, she was appointed, you know, by Rusbridge as part of his process.
I'm not sure Alan has decided is probably the biggest, most accurate assessment of that. I think one of the things it shows, isn't it, the world changes fast, and if you're not around to be part of those discussions, some other people will.
His editorial, you know, ability and success is unquestionable, but it's a loss-making organisation. It loses about £1 million a week. His refusal to embrace any sort of paywall or digital economy for The Guardian is how can you do that if you're running a business, which is what his job was. You know, the journalism is one thing, but the losing £1 million a week is another thing. And David Pemsel, who I work with at Shine, who's part of the original launch team of Shine with Liz Murdoch, is a very, very smart, very commercial individual who won't want to sit there losing £45 million a year. So the Rusbridge era is over for The Guardian. You can't continue to lose that amount of money and get away with it, particularly when you have, you know, you've got a very valuable digital brand there that is not getting any return on the investment.
Yeah, I mean, the issue with having him at the Scott Trust is, I guess, that's the organisation that says, no, carry on losing money, it's fine. They're the buffer, aren't they?
They also trade in money doesn't last forever, though, does it?
No, and it's rapidly running out.
And I think running out at a faster rate than they'd expected at the point in which it was supposed to be the buffer that took them through to profitability.
Okay, let's go from the Guardian to one of the other big English language news sites in the world, the Mail. The Daily Mail and General Trust, who own the Daily Mail and its Sunday Title as well, released its half-year results this week. Figures revealed strong growth for Mail Online, unsurprisingly, up £12 million compared to just 6 months earlier. But the print revenues are down by £18 million, which has led the Trust to issue a profit warning. The context here, though, is we're seeing cuts at The Guardian, cuts at The Telegraph, possibly The Mirror as well. What do you think is going on?
Well, The Mail proves that it's much cheaper to reprint other people's articles than to make your own. Is it a surprise that print revenues are in decline? No. I think these things have seemed to level off a bit recently, and with digital growth, you know, still providing more benefits to those publications. But I think everyone has had a tough first 6 months of the year as people's advertisers' spending habits are changing at a significant clip. And also digital display, traditional banner-based display, not a sexy format, something that's having a lot of issues with ad blocking, which now is becoming a real thing, not just a thing that we talk about. So you can't just benefit from the market increasing. And so that's your double trouble, isn't it? Your print's definitely now in the toilet, and even your bright new future of online is in growth, but maybe not at the speed and the format you need it to be.
The advertisers, though, Kenton, are apparently going to digital. Tesco and BT apparently spending more and more now on digital, less and less on print. Do you think that's wise? I mean, if you were in charge of their strategy, would you be saying, yeah, we need to reach more people digitally?
The best way to reach the most people is television. You know, ITV is still the biggest audience available to any advertiser, and that's why its advertising revenue is pretty robust, despite all the fears at the moment. It's a very robust business.
But it's less bespoke. You don't know exactly who's watching. You just know millions of them are.
But if you want mass, that's what you need to do. And those big brands, you know, have a sophisticated strategy of mass and class. So they know, you know, they've got a sophisticated matrix for getting large numbers and also targeting the niche. Do I care that Daily Mail is losing money? No. Do I care that investment in quality journalism is under threat because of the decline in print? Yes, it's being a journalist now, being a writer is incredibly challenging. They don't, you know, rates of pay have gone down, opportunities have gone down, entry points have gone down. So where is the next generation of print journalists? Where are they being trained? How are they going to be paid? How are you going to make a living doing it? That's a real threat, I think, to, you know, the society and the culture in which we live. If we haven't got well-funded, well-resourced journalists at newspapers being paid properly to do their job.
Of course, if you move 15% of your TV ad spend to radio, it gives you 7 times return on investment.
Well, again, Matt, you've pushed us on to our next topic. This is your moment to shine. We're going to talk Rajars. Come back, everybody. I've had some people say my favourite bit of the media podcast is the in-depth Rajar analysis.
Oh, dear.
I've had very much other people say the opposite. But if you're a radio nerd, this is the bit we do once a quarter with Matt Deegan, which you will absolutely love. The radio industry's audience body has released its figures for this quarter. Not good news for Chris Moores. Let's start off with that.
No, complex. It's hard.
It's not complex. He's lost half his audience.
He's only lost half his audience in half the country. In the other half of the country, he's tripled it.
Tell us how.
So the problem with Moores is, so XFM used to be on London, used to be in London and Manchester on FM with a splattering of digital around the country, to now a national radio station on DAB with simulcasting on London and Manchester FM. They put Moyles on at the breakfast show. And they spent a lot of money on marketing, and they spent a lot of money on Moyles. The show is a good show. It's very listenable. He has mellowed slightly. It's an interesting thing. However, this is their first figures nationally. And what's happened? In the bits outside of London and Manchester, his audience has pretty much tripled.
Wow.
So that's people who never listen to XFM, obviously don't like what they can get on the radio in their places where they live, and have moved to that show. And not only are they more people listening, the amount they're listening to that radio station has increased at an even higher rate. So, you know, they really like consuming that content, and him particularly. In London and in Manchester, it's pretty much flat from the old station and the old breakfast show with Tim Cocker, who's now on Virgin Radio. In London, he's seen a massive drop. And some of that might be some radio sampling bits and pieces. You know, radio's all about trends. One-off quarters isn't, you know, the perfect representation. But the drop is significant. And you would say they have perhaps churned a hell of a lot of XFM, more XFM listeners than they had expected to. They haven't been able to top up right. with new Radio X listeners. The question is, have they got the right marketing mix for that show and that station in super competitive places? You know, we were just talking in London on digital radio, in which now over half of Londoners have, there are 70 radio stations on the dial. You know, it's even with Moyles and a decently accessible mainstream rock format, it is hard to cut.
So it could be transitional. They could have lost that hardcore London audience that found the old XFM, and they've got to grow that now, and it's going to take longer because the format's changed, the music policy's changed.
Absolutely. So I think they're pretty much starting from scratch everywhere. Yeah. If you look at XFM network as a total now, Radio X network as a total now, it's up to a 1.2 million reach, up from sort of 800,000. So you talk to the global guys, they'll say, you know, we have built a new radio station from scratch, and it has more than a million listeners.
And I know that if you were to ask the controller of Radio X, he'd probably say, well, radios never do very well for us. They never did very well for XFM because we're aimed at kind of basically men in their 20s to 40s who...
Non-diary tickers.
When the radio guy comes around and says, would you like a £40 Marks & Spencer voucher, aren't there. Mm. So the kind of people that listen to Radio X just don't fill in the diaries. Is that fair?
Not really. I think... One the reason radio costs the industry so much money is it's a massive survey. They survey 25,000 people a quarter, which change every quarter, 100,000 people a year. They get all the sampling right. You know,
they build that into the sampling. They would understand that.
And they have to find all those people, and they spend more money and more effort trying to get those people to either fill in the diary or do it online or on their phones, which they can now do.
Okay, so let's talk about London still and talk about BBC London. They had a big rebrand, didn't they? They're now Radio London.
Yeah.
And their audience is not very good.
Disappointing. Yeah. I think LBC News, which is a rolling kind of news package radio station, is doing better than BBC London is.
Which is on AM in most people's cars.
Absolutely.
Which is, I mean, that's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues for BBC London is, you know, what is a BBC London radio station for? You know, BBC Shropshire does very well because the market, the people who listen to that radio station are all quite similar and live similar lifestyles or have done. BBC London, you know, diverse market. And also, we have another local London radio station. It's called Radio 4. And, you know, that is London's most popular radio station.
Yeah.
By far. And that sucks up a lot of that audience. Is it possible... they've sort of changed some of the presenters on BBC London. And it's made... You know, it's taken the people who did listen to it have kind of pushed them away. Maybe what they should do with BBC London is replace it with One Extra or the Asian Network or do something a bit more different, or even maybe Six Music.
Is Robert Elms their biggest show?
I don't know anymore because they've switched him to mid-mornings,
right.
I think. But it's a difficult challenge for them. They are seemingly not doing a very good job at it at the moment. I think Six Music is bigger than BBC London is.
Okay, you're allowed one more Radio headline. It's your choice.
I'm loving it. Yeah. I used to work in radio. I think this is the most fascinating part of my week.
So the one
it's KISS or LBC or it's Radio 1. You
no,
choose.
The one I'd say is digital radio consumption.
Okay.
So this is listening on DAB, DTV or the internet, accounts for, I think we're up to, I haven't got the numbers in front of me, 44%, I think.
Wow.
That is a huge percentage. You know, that's, no matter what platform you like and you listen to, you know, we've created, the radio industry has created a selection of services and platforms, non-traditional ones, that half of all listening now is given to those places. Wow. That might be listening to LBC outside of London, that might be listening to Capital on FM, that might be listening to talk sport on the internet. And this is great news for radio because, you know, we're not tied to those FM and AM transmitters. You know, it's a proper multi-platform beast. And I think that's, again, why we're in quite a good position and the money's going up, is because it's relatively flexible.
Okay. Radio nerds, you're going to get one more story, but we're going to move on to the story about the new presenter of Pick of the Pops. Tony Blackburn, of course, no longer at the BBC for reasons we've discussed previously. They've now replaced him permanently with Paul Gambaccini.
Hurrah.
Plus, Fern Cotton is coming to Saturday mornings. Do we get a hurrah for that or a boo?
You get a no comment.
You get a no comment from Kenton. She's going to be co-hosting a show with, I've forgotten his name, what's his name?
Martin
Kemp.
Yes.
Thank you. She's going to be co-hosting a show with Martin Kemp on Saturday mornings, whilst Graham Norton is on his summer break. Kenton, you hurrahed first of all about the return of Gambo.
I think he's one of the great broadcasters. He's a huge fan. He's got encyclopedic knowledge. He's a brilliant storyteller. His American chart show, which is on Saturday nights, I think. is brilliant. He's a brilliant broadcaster. He's a brilliant man. You know, he's had a terrible time, unreasonably and unjustly, and it's great the BBC are having him back. I think it's to be applauded, and I shall be listening.
But, I mean, very difficult to fill Blackburn's shoes, obviously, especially under these circumstances. But they had Mark Goodyear filling in for him recently.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, personally, I think is quite a bland presenter. But for that, like, he's known for the charts.
Yes.
In a way, is a better fit than Gambo,
well,
isn't it?
I think Mark Goodyear does a great job. And I think for people of our age who grew up with Mark Goodyear doing the chart, who have maybe moved, whether reluctantly or not, to listen to Radio 2, he's a great fit. I think Dale Winton did it before Tony Blackburn.
Yeah.
So it's a big sort of twist. But actually, maybe that's what he needs. You know, replicating a sort
I think so. I think it could be really exciting because I think I listen to Brian Masters occasionally on Saturday morning.
What, Sound of the 60s?
Yeah, because
he
drops in little nuggets of story or history or biography, and I think if Gambaccini does that on what is a fairly standard chart show and just brings it to life, it could be great listening, I think, because his knowledge is probably, he's probably the best in the country at having that detailed knowledge of the history of rock and roll.
Okay, and the Fern Cotton thing, let's, perhaps unfairly to her, but sorry, I'm going to focus on the fact she's a woman because we're talking about Radio 2. Is Bob Shannon doing enough with this to bring women to the station? Basically, all the deputies are women, but there aren't very many women in daytime.
Well, the problem is that there are now 972 people waiting for the daytime schedule on Radio 2 to change. There's just been more and more people from Zoe Ball and Sarah Cox. And that's just the women. I mean, there's a whole load of men as well who quite like
Richard Madeley, Chris Tarrant,
their hands
Richard
on something
Bacon.
In daytime. So it's the ultimate juggernaut. Now
there is a Radio 2 extra with all these people. That would be absolutely.
That's a very good idea.
Oh yeah, it would be better.
Well, they wanted Six Music to be that. But and this is the challenge that they face. And also, it doesn't help all of those 972 that the daytime lineup on Radio 2 is so strong. It is almost bulletproof. You know, someone like Steve Wright, love him or hate him.
Love the show, Steve.
As many people do. Millions of listeners. I mean, really difficult to go, you know what, we're gonna change this for the good of the, you know, because we think we should. I think Furnace Presenter has improved massively, as did Sarah Cox, from, you know, very sort of wobbly start on Radio 1. Something that's a very funny, down-to-earth, relatable presenter now. Any of them, I think, could do it, but do you want to replace someone who's brilliant at the moment?
No, and also, let's face it, there's a shameful lack of diversity. It's an all-white lineup, has been for years. It's, you know, the scrutiny that we are rightly under in television about increasing diversity, which is to be applauded. What on earth is going on in radio?
Moira Stewart reads the news, Kenton. That's enough for everyone.
Tokenism, you know, it's just not good enough. And they're getting away with it. I don't understand it.
And I think also that's even before you look behind the scenes.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
radio is a, you know, is a
it's hideously white. Exactly.
Yeah, no, good point. All right.
As we all are.
Indeed, yes. And we're all men. Right, finally this week, let's talk about Netflix and Amazon being given some scheduling advice by the European Commission. Kenton, you alluded to this earlier. You think it's a good thing?
Well, I think it is a good thing, yeah.
What's the story?
The European Commission have decided that Netflix and Amazon need to produce 20% of their content from domestic producers in Europe. The French are very strong on that, as we know, in terms of their commitment to domestic production. It's happened organically here with British broadcasters because audiences prefer domestic content to foreign content on the whole.
And Americans love the accent.
I think Netflix and Amazon are doing it anyway. I don't, you know, there's not a lack of it going on. And I think they're a bit annoyed about the EU sticking their oar in. But it's to be applauded because it just reminds them that they need to serve the local audiences as well as the global audiences, and you want a rich mix of shows. And, you know, I know that Netflix have just announced their first Latin American series. They have big plans to produce domestic content in local territories, and the UK is not a priority because it's English language, but they've got a team working on where they can produce local content in their growth areas. So it's probably unnecessary, but it doesn't hurt to remind enormous American corporations that they have responsibility to provide local content as well as these global kind of mega brands?
Netflix repertoire, I think at the moment, is 21% European, so they're kind of slightly exceeding the thing.
But you do wonder how much of that is British. It is probably the vast majority of that.
And also the other option is you can just, you know, buy every old episode of something like Pointless. You know, if you want to play the numbers game.
But they won't do that because that won't deliver an audience.
But they don't need. They just need to be. They just need it to be in the.
I mean, they're spending $100. They're spending $100 million a series on The Crown. You know, that's the biggest ever drama series commissioned out of the UK. They're not slow in coming to us wanting content. I think the European point of view is probably a bit more protectionist about France, Germany, Italy, Spain, where there's not so much demand from Netflix for that content.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, before we go, there is just time for our media quiz.
Woo! What?
This week it is entitled Digital Disruptor. We were all set to make the questions really easy, but then Mobile Network 3 blocked anything that looked like advertising. So, can you guess which people and publications have been blocked from these headlines? That's the game. It is a little bit like Blankety Blank, for my taste. The winner is blank, the loser is blank. Best of three, buzz in with your name. Blank Blank says the blank, not blank blank, lobbied government to clip wings of blank.
Matt. Ed Vasey.
Yeah.
Said that Channel 4 are close. Not Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Oh, no, The Guardian,
yes.
Not Rupert Murdoch.
Very good.
The ones who wanted to do in the BBC in the white paper.
Very good, yes. So this was in Parliament, wasn't it? Ed Vasey said the only people that have been lobbying me not to clip the wings of the BBC were not, as everyone thinks, The Times and The Sun, but The Guardian. What did you make of that, Kenton?
Ed's quite mischievous.
You can read all the white paper meeting list in the back of the white paper if you want to get into the appendices.
If you haven't got a life.
Yes, and everyone met the government to probably do it.
I think it's Ed being mischievous.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's do 10 seconds on Recipe Gate. What do you think of that? Everyone's got an opinion on that.
It's mad, isn't it? That something that exists should be taken off, and it's not really being taken off. It's going
to
be...
It's been moved to Good Food, isn't it?
It's been moved to a commercial website where they can make money for the BBC. I mean, what? Yeah. How's that better?
The BBC needs to not do everything, and if it saves some money and creates money that can keep journalists working at the BBC doing proper journalism, publicly funded, then I think that's a good thing. So you've got, you know, they've got some cuts to make. I think it's a sensible thing to do. The audience won't be deprived of it. It will move to a commercial website. I don't see the issue.
So long as they keep the gazpacho recipe on, that's all that's important to me. Right, here's question number two. Blanks, blank, blank, to return for two more seasons.
Kenton. Peaky Blinders.
Yes.
To return for two more seasons.
Yes, BBC's Peaky Blinders to return for two more seasons. We'd all make that decision, wouldn't we, if we were in charge?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? And it's a huge vote of confidence, and keeping that cast together is very difficult. So to keep Cillian Murphy on board, you need to give him some commitment. The show's, you know, he's the heart and soul of the show, so it's terrific. And it's a very, very, very brilliant, slightly terrifying show. I watched it this week. It's there's a lot of blood and guts in it.
There is. Right, we're at a tie break. Very exciting.
Yeah.
Here it is, question
Game
number
on.
Three.
What's the prize?
we blanked it out, so I don't know. Blank blank appoints blank deputy as London bureau chief ahead of video expansion.
Oh, Matt.
Matt.
Man from Newsnight, now man from Vice.
if you can fill in the blanks any better, Kenton, I'd be prepared
no,
to split this.
There,
no, okay. It was Vice News appoints Newsnight deputy as London bureau chief ahead of video expansion. So some jobs going from Vice, but obviously they're spending in other areas.
Yeah, so they're launching Viceland TV channel in a lot of territories. And I imagine that they need to work out how they can churn out a load of cheap local content to fill Viceland UK to go in between programmes made by more famous people in America.
I told you we'd end on a note of cynicism. but
Matt optimism, Dean. No. It's going to be great, Viceland. I look forward to their relationships with Ofcom.
as Nicholas Parsons would say, we found your contribution very amusing, Kenton. But
Thank
Matt
you.
Deegan, you are the winner. That is our show for today. If you are new to this show, hi, glad you can make it. If you subscribe, you can get us every single fortnight, bang on time. You can do that via iTunes, of course. If you've got an iPhone, it's on the Podcasts app. Or if you've got an Android phone, what about Pocket Casts? There's a whole number of other podcatchers as well. Wherever you find us, press subscribe. And then that way you'll never miss an episode. Go and do it now. We'd like to dedicate this episode this week to Alan Forbes, an assistant producer for STV Glasgow. He is our latest monthly subscriber. Thank you, Alan. And big thanks to Roy Martin of I'm Roy Martin fame from Radio Today. He made a very generous donation to this week's pod as well. Thank you, Roy. Join Alan, join Roy. Go to themediapodcast.com/dedicate. Do it now. Help support the show. Thanks. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer is Matt Hill. And the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.